Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 541.1S1718, certificate number 24553. Government cheese.
Don't make me say cheese. Oh, you done lined up for some cheese before. Oh, I done been in the line for some cheese. Oh, be in line all day. I'm gonna tell you something about government cheese. I said it right, government cheese. Not government, government cheese. Government cheese make the best grilled cheese you done ever had in your life. Oh, you can't eat a better grilled cheese than government cheese, but you got one problem. You got to cut it though. Oh, this ain't no Velveeta. This ain't individually wrapped. You got to put some pressure on a butcher knife to cut some government cheese.
I like how you put the N in government.
I always just say government.
Government cheese.
Because if somebody says government, I guess you say government. Government, like David Letterman used to.
Government cheese.
The government men are coming with their government cheese.
You like cheese.
Oh, man, everybody likes cheese.
Well, not everybody.
My son does not like cheese.
That's right. I've eaten at your house where he was prepared a special plate sans cheese.
I have a daughter who will not eat meat because she's a lovely, evolved, enlightened person.
Hi, Caitlin.
And I have a son who won't eat cheese because he's an awful little prima donna.
Dylan.
The worst.
How's the lactose intolerance in your family?
We are not intolerant about anything in our North Seattle family, including lactose. I love dairy in all its forms. I often have thought that I could become a vegetarian more easily than I could give up dairy.
You know, there's a lot of sort of scoffing about lactose intolerance as a sort of modern problem, but lactose intolerance is a real issue, and it's very different depending on sort of your 70+% 75% of African Americans are lactose intolerant.
Yeah, it's elevated in I think in Native Americans and Asian Americans and Asian people too, right?
I mean 80% lactose intolerance, whereas in Caucasians it's only 20% of the people.
I don't know if this is true, but when I was growing up in Korea as one of the only white people around, I feel like I was told that Asians thought, and probably correctly, that white people just smelled like cheese. Because they did not eat dairy. They were very sensitive to the smell of dairy.
What a terrible thing to say.
Isn't that the...
smell like cheese.
Like, you'll never think you're the Great White Hope or the master race anymore if you realize you're the race that smells like cheese.
I really feel like that is maybe the biggest dog, put down you could say to somebody. And I'm going to start saying it to people that are mean to me.
Your mom smells like cheese.
You know what? Eat snakes. You smell like cheese.
Is eat snakes your go-to insult?
Eat snakes is a pretty good insult.
Are you one of the Bowery boys?
I feel like, you know, I've been calling people ding-dongs for a long time, and I watched that Zach Galifianakis movie last night.
Oh, is it funny?
At one point he starts talking about how he starts dropping ding-dongs into his conversation, and I feel like although there are a million ways that Zach Galifianakis could have come to ding-dongs, feel like it might be my little contribution
to
the world.
You think it could be you?
Having said it, so not that he got it directly from me, but it, you know, it percolates out. I got it from Scott Danbaum in Denton, Texas. So.
I feel like alt comedy is very rich with that kind of old-timey insult.
Yeah, ding dong. But, you know, a lot of alt comedy comes from me.
I didn't know that. Yeah, I was going to say Patton Oswalt or Sarah Silverman, but apparently it was you. So you could switch to like yo-yo.
There's other options. No, I'm going to start saying you smell like cheese, eat snakes.
It's not an adjective. Though. I mean, it's not a noun. You could say
cheese smell.
Cheese
people.
Cheese head.
Cheeser.
Wait, that's a...
No, not cheese
Packers
heads.
Fan.
Don't get us started. Growing up, I'm guessing that you ate all the processed American cheeses that you could.
Oh boy. So my parents were both of the same kind of better home and better homes and gardens, better living through chemistry generation.
Right.
So we ate a lot of Jell-O. We ate a lot of weird salads on lettuce leaves, ate a lot of casseroles.
It's cultural patrimony.
It's my birthright as a white suburban kid. And one of those things was just slices of Kraft singles. My mom would use Velveeta, unironically, for nachos.
Did you know that Kraft Singles, although it's described as a sliced cheese, is not sliced?
They pour them in molds?
Yeah. Kraft Singles are made as individual slices.
I guess that's why they're called singles.
Yeah, but they're not slices. And there's no other way to describe them except as...
Yeah, what would you call it? Squares.
Yeah,
squares,
right. They're squares. They're not sliced from anything.
Do you know how it works? Does liquid slurry pour into a square pan?
Yeah, I guess. They probably have a tiny little conveyor belt that just has cheese, you know, cheese-shaped little slices when you think about it. Well, wait. Yeah, the singles actually show the imprint of the plastic wrap that
they
contains
do.
Them.
You can see the Mylar envelope.
So they must still be somewhat damp when they are wrapped.
I feel like the commercial implies there's a big block of Kraft singles, Kraft block
together
edges, and then it gets sliced.
Yeah, unfortunately, no. Or maybe a better way of saying that is fortunately no, because each individually hermetically sealed wrap of cheese is its own unique product.
It's important to note that I should not be sneering at my parents for coming from a generation where that was just middle class food. You know, like today, everybody is a food snob where you would say, oh, no, I eat Manchego cheese from Central Spain on my tuna melt or whatever.
Can you imagine a Manchego tuna melt?
That did not exist.
Gross.
Like there were maybe four cities in the world where there were more than five different cheeses.
Well, it's funny that you mention it because mocking processed cheese is, not only a time-honored American tradition, but it is something that characterizes the last 40 years in American culture. Like, as great as processed cheese is, it also became symbolic with a lot of things. Industrial food, it became like a symbolism of American lack of taste, and it became a symbolism of poverty or of being unable to not just appreciate but afford better food.
I assume the poverty vector is something the history of that is what we're going to discuss today. Because when I've heard about government cheese, it's definitely in that context.
That's right.
It's a stand-up comedian talking about their kind of inner city upbringing or whatever. And it's a real signifier of that.
Yeah. Government cheese became a stand-in for all sort of assistance, you know, government assistance, welfare, food stamps, food bank.
Post-Great Society kind of welfare apparatus America.
That's right. And so it has a lot of, it has tremendous social connotations in the U.S., but also in a larger sweep, processed cheese of all kinds are kind of, they became a demarcator of class.
And maybe nationality. US. I feel like America is still made fun of today for having our kind of, just as our chocolate is kind of gross and waxy and overprocessed. Like, we don't know what good cheese is in this country, right?
And processed cheese eventually became American cheese, and we call it American cheese with pride. because Although processed cheese was not invented in America, it originally was a product of Switzerland.
Interesting.
If you can believe it.
A country that has many great cheeses.
Wonderful cheeses. A man
but they
the
were like, there should be fewer holes in this.
Well, you know, there are a lot of problems with cheese, right? It's expensive to produce, time-consuming. It spoils mm-hmm. readily. It is...
You're really down on cheese.
Well, listen, if I could eliminate cheese from my diet...
I like I already have a list of grudges with cheese.
I'd be 40 pounds lighter.
Are you lactose intolerant?
I'd be able to fly... I'm not, but I think at the level of cheese that I consume, you're just not meant to eat that much cheese.
I was at a baseball game last night and I got a cookie with a scoop of ice cream
cheese?
On it.
Oh, I thought you were going to say.
Cookie with a scoop of cheese. I had an apple pie with a slice of cheddar cheese.
Got a hanker for a hunker.
And it said with a scoop. And so I got it with a scoop and I had this ginormous thing of ice cream. And I tried to fob it off on the other people I was with, but I ended up eating too much ice cream mm-hmm. and I was feeling it for the rest of the night.
It'll slow you right down.
And I don't know if that's lactose intolerance or just awful gluttony, but I was not feeling like a healthy man.
Yeah. I cannot claim, to have lactose intolerance, but I remember when I first moved to Seattle and was first introduced to coffee really as a thing, you know, my mom drank Sanka. I wasn't interested in coffee. It just seemed like some gross thing adults did. But when I moved to Seattle in my early 20s...
We've replaced John's Folgers with actual Starbucks coffee. Let's watch.
I would go to the local cafe and you know, somebody gave me a latte, right? Some friend that was like, you got to try this latte. And it was delicious. And like a lot of things in the early 90s, I thought... It was because it was sophisticated. It was probably good for me, and so I started drinking.
Does that happen? Ooh, no, cigarettes
for sure.
This looks cool. It must be healthy.
Sure. I mean, that's a lot of the choices I made were in those early years were based on like, is this sophisticated? Well, it must improve me.
Kids can't drink coffee. Grown-ups do. Therefore, right.
So I started drinking 4 pint glasses of latte a day, and I noticed I had an awful lot of expectorant by the end of the day. I was loaded up with, I'd consumed basically a gallon of whole milk. And it was only later that I realized, hey, wait, I don't need all the milk. It doesn't have to be a latte. Once I was addicted to the coffee,
it's the hard stuff.
Yeah. It's the Johnny Appleseed story, you know, they come along, get you hooked on cider. And pretty soon you're drinking a gallon of milk a day.
Is that the Johnny Appleseed story?
The Disney cartoon confused me about what the Johnny Appleseed story really was about. But processed cheese, kind of self-evident why making a cheese food that was shelf stable, easy to manufacture, melted evenly.
Yeah, let me say the melting is huge. Yeah. I mean, if you get a McDonald's or a Burger King burger anywhere in the world, it will be made with smooth, evenly melting American cheese, and people love it. Nobody sneers at it and says, but this should be our Roquefort.
Right. That's right. You definitely do not want nachos made with camembert, but you also don't want it made with just big chunks of hard cheddar because right. It will separate into the oil and the kind of whey and the other, you know, the curds. It will separate into
cheese doesn't bear thinking about too much.
Solids.
I don't want to know what's in there.
Whereas processed cheese has this even melting. But also processed cheese in a country the size of the United States where dairy production is focused in certain areas and you want to make food available to a broad cross-section of people, including people living in urban areas where there's not a big cheese manufacturing, you know, local industry. Processing cheese and making it into a commodity food, it has a lot of advantages, even before you get into questions of cost.
We talk a lot about foods that get worse when you have to ship them, like how produce is worse now and cheese is. There should be some food that gets better in its modern
Dr. Pepper
truck ready form.
I mean, the further the Dr. Pepper has to travel, the better it is.
I have this problem at any Seattle restaurant of trying to order a Diet Coke or something and having them say like, oh, sure, we can make you one of our low sugar house cola shrubs with balsamic vinegar. And mm-hmm. no, when I say I want a Diet Coke, don't say, yes, we have something different. Just say, no, we only have weird sodas.
We're going to make you a ginger beer and call it a Diet Dr. Pepper.
There are definitely places that where if you order a ginger beer, they will just mix Coke and Sprite and tell you it's raining.
Come on. And
tell you it's raining ginger
Come
ale.
Come on.
And that is not how you make ginger ale.
Bring me my processed American food.
So that, I guess you're right. Soda is one food that does get better when it's standardized for the long haul.
Yeah, well, and I mean, there's so much in American food processing that we come to take for granted. I mean, you know, if you go to McDonald's, you're going to get a McDonald's burger, and you know that that has all of the dangers, and there's a lot of smugness around it. But
all the preservatives that will keep it in your system for 20 years.
But when you think about the many, 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 many different foods, including just the pasta you buy at the supermarket, I mean, it all is manufactured according to any more industrial scale and industrial manufacturing processes, right? There's nothing that's – it's the rare thing like a Frito that where the ingredients are corn, oil, salt.
I wouldn't know. I only eat weird artisanal things that cost $20 more than their mass market alternatives.
Well, the innovation in America of processed cheese really does surprisingly start with James Kraft, who
there's a guy named Kraft with a K. I guess he was. I guess we should know. It's related to the Patriots guy, I assume.
Yeah,
all the Kraft with a K's are related.
Kraft with a K. He patented in America of processed food or processed cheese food.
It sounds like a trade name. It's like Kleenex. It's a word related to the thing it is, Kraft. But with the C replaced with a K.
Yeah, right. It's a Kraft cheese.
But there was actually a guy.
But it's Mr. Kraft, right. And Mr. Kraft was, you know.
If you have a name like that, you have to put your name on a building because it's so perfect for,
it's a great
for corporate
name, right?
America at the time.
Right? You have to wonder what Roderick suggests I should do. I think it suggests...
It's not futuristic. It's very old-timey.
Yeah, Roderick. It's
bespoke suits. You're a tailor or something.
Right, or I feel like a...
British race car from the 30s, maybe?
Yeah, okay. That's not bad.
I drive the Roderick Model 20.
No, even that doesn't... It sounds like a car that would get beat by an Austin Healey.
The car loses at Le Mans every year.
I feel like a Roderick is just a small town city councilman who is on the take.
It could be a raincoat.
Oh, yeah. Put on your Roderick.
Yeah, it often seems... It could be a lowercase r. Like in if some part of Britain that calls galoshes Rodericks, I would totally believe that.
Yeah, that's
that.
Exactly right. I feel like a Jennings is a better car than a Roderick.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Driving my new... The 7-liter Jennings.
Maybe it's just because your own name just sounds like, to you, your own name will never sound like anything but your name.
Right.
Like, I have a hard time imagining Jennings as a trade name. I don't know. Jennings could be like maybe a caramel, like a Werther's original kind of a thing.
You know, Roderick is a very popular first name in the African-American community. So if you go looking for Rodericks, you'll find a lot of guys named like, you know, Roderick James or Roderick, you know, Roderick Fred or whatever, like two first names type of thing.
And do you feel like you're down because of that?
No, I feel like there's already a lot of confusion about like what the hell Roderick even is. Mm. Like where, what the last king of the Visigoths was named Roderick. That's kind of my claim to fame. So Kraft started making processed cheese and actually the Velveeta company started up right about this same time. No, it was a guy named Emil Frey.
They're competitors.
Originally, although Kraft bought Velveeta in the
20s. What a weird thing. So you take velvet because you want to convey its smooth texture.
Right.
And then you have to instead of adding a K, you have to change the E. Velveeta.
Although in overseas territories, Velveeta was often marketed as Velveeta.
Oh, really?
They took the second E out in Germany, it wouldn't have symbolized... Small velvet or whatever.
That sounds a little too anatomical.
Velveeta.
Like, make sure to have your Velveeta examined once a year.
Processed cheese. So Kraft bought Velveeta during the Depression. And in the 30s, processed cheese was regarded as not just a modern innovative food, but it was thought of as a very healthy... part of an American diet, and Velveeta was given the first food product given the American Medical Association seal of approval.
Really?
In the 1930s.
The AMA has been waiting for the perfect health food, and they finally see Velveeta.
Yeah, here it is.
This is it.
Sure you have Velveeta in every day.
This is what we'll be eating in our undersea cities and on Mars. Yeah, I guess that's true. Like all these new foods that now we think of as kind of kitschy, like they were not just convenient, like they were thought of as better because they were the future. Like a can of pineapple was a fancy, healthful treat to people who had not been able to eat pineapple up until then.
Think about the first time you saw a can of pineapple.
And now, of course, you know, it just seems, you know, like it's a generation ago that you would crack a can of pineapple as an ingredient in something and put it on a ham.
No, you drop it in your Jello.
That's right.
And you melt some Velveeta over it.
Put it in my cottage cheese and put it on a lettuce leaf and you got yourself a salad going.
The thing about processed cheese is that it lends itself very well to being treated as something other than just a food. Because
what else is it? It's a floor wax?
Well, it is within the United States, and this is true all over the world, when governments get involved in managing markets and in particular managing food production and distribution, food begins to be thought of as a commodity. And we've talked about this in the Onion Futures episode recently. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a government, as it administers a larger territory and population, has an obligation to, even within a completely market economy, the government has an obligation to not let surpluses of food build up in one part of the territory while somewhere else in the territory there is tremendous need, right? I mean, a government, even though...
You're going to get letters from libertarians.
I know. Even though
the market should take care of that.
Even though we're not in a socialist economy here in the United States, there is a lot of government intervention in markets and in production and distribution because... It's just a really bad look to have a bunch of rich farmers sitting on mountains of cheese and a bunch of poor workers starving to
death. Is this related to social welfare, or do we think there's efficiencies where, you know, we just need to smooth out, you know, eventually capitalism would solve the problem of too many people making the wrong cheese, but it's more efficient if government can catch it quicker?
Well, so both things. There is a welfare component, but there's also a kind of within a food market from season to season, supply can change radically, right? I mean, you can have a bad harvest and all of a sudden there's no food.
You see it today. Like the price of something will go up $2 and you'll realize California doesn't have enough avocados this year or whatever.
So there's a lot. So within the political realm, there's a lot of impetus for politicians to try and guarantee sort of some price stability over time from season to season. It's part of modern industrialization of food manufacture, but also it's true for oil and other commodities. You don't want, for instance, just recently the attack on the Saudi oil refinery. You don't want that to create a scenario where suddenly the price of gas goes from $3 a gallon to $30 a gallon.
So you can protect against shortage by using...
stockpiling. Yeah. Price supports work a couple of different ways. There are subsidies for producers to try and, you know, make it worth their while to make to produce the commodities
that
we
need. You're incentivizing the production of something that of which there are shortages,
or where there's not necessarily a profitable market for it at the moment, right? I mean, you see this in mining all the time. The price of copper will fall below a certain threshold, and they'll just shut down the copper mines because they're not profitable. It's not profitable to mine copper.
And the argument for keeping it going is it just a form of welfare for the workers, for the employees, to keep the industry alive, or is it like actually we can't have this kind of stop and starting? The need for copper is going to come back, and we want that supply chain to be intact.
Within agriculture, it's definitely a form of welfare.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, in welfare for the producer.
I feel like it's an underappreciated kind of welfare, because usually tirades about welfare target a certain kind of welfare recipient who is not a white Nebraska farmer.
Well, and that happened in later on in our government cheese story. The other side of it is price controls, and the government imposes, this is another form of price support. Government imposes price controls on commodities in order to protect the consumer from wild fluctuations in price. So you get this kind of, you try and create a perfect symbiosis between the government, giving support in the form of subsidies to producers while also protecting consumers
from getting gouged.
Right. And
so you're just kind of sanding off the,
but it's an incredibly inefficient system. And your libertarian friends are going to say, like, let the market decide. But what the market ends up producing sometimes is famine. And also, like,
we're speaking to libertarian coral reefs who are very annoyed that you think any kind of central planning is going to help here, John.
But during World War II, it was sort of one of the first instances where we saw within the country, partly because there was rationing happening, but also the way that the FDR and the New Deal had worked out arrangements with farmers and producers. And we talked about this a long time ago on the show in the Water Wars episode.
Right.
Where the government is engaged in setting or depressing or inflating the price of something well outside what the market necessarily would bear, and then protecting those interests in the form of legislation. So guaranteeing farmers will never make less than this, or in the case of the dairy industry. The government often will just buy up herds of dairy cows to take those cows out of production because we have too much cheese.
Is this just pure pork for constituents, or is there some idea that, like, would economists defend this as a way of stabilizing a chaotic market? Or
I think most economists would agree that it's not a very efficient way of stabilizing supply and demand. It often ends up being used in political football in a thing that's a process that's described as log rolling, where the Democrats will want food subsidies for poor people, and the Republicans will say will then sort of extract concessions for their farming, their farmer constituencies, where the farmers are subsidized in part by a government guarantee that they will buy this food on behalf of the poor. I mean, it's
so interconnected that pretty much every bill of this kind will have both things now.
Right.
And it'll, if you want your food stamps, you're going to have your corn, your ethanol subsidies. Sorry.
And what's crazy is that the United States is a 100% a welfare state, and every single person, all the rich people that are like, I built this. It's like, well, actually, when you take the government subsidies out,
the benefits you receive are no longer controversial benefits. Like Social Security, that's not a handout.
No.
I had that coming, but other people's benefits, those are the iffy ones.
Yeah, Social Security, I paid into it. During World War II, there was an attempt to create... Well, it was the origin of the food stamp. And the idea of the food stamp was that if you you would buy food stamps, they weren't just given to you, you purchased them. But if you purchased a certain number of food stamps, you would get other food stamps for what were regarded as surplus commodities. So food was...
Is this part of ration? Is this part of wartime rationing?
Yeah. Okay. But food was being harvested places, and... There were too many corn cobs or too many Ritz crackers in one part of the country, and in order to distribute that among a population that was already suffering from food shortages, this sort of the food stamp program incentivized people to eat these certain foods.
You don't want salt cod. You don't have recipes for salt cod, but we've got too much salt.
We've got too much salt cod. So here's some cheap. Here's an opportunity if you buy. If you buy food stamps for food you want, you get cheap cheap access to this other food.
It's a bonus food.
Bonus. And it worked through the war, and then it at the end of the war, we had dealt with the surpluses, and the program kind of wrapped up. But during the Kennedy years, I mean, food subsidies were debated throughout the 50s as a, you know, this was an era when we were, there had been a dramatic urbanization in the manufacturing corridors of the West. I mean, the Midwest and West. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, Detroit had become a huge city and Los Angeles. And so we had urban poor in a way that was different from the traditional urban
kind
poor.
Of the immigrant tenements of past decades.
Right. These were people that had worked in the wartime factories and, or had just migrated to the cities. And so there was a disconnect between the rural food production and people living in cities. And by the Kennedy administration, this evolution of what became sort of the Great Society of Johnson, we'd started to really, there was a lot of work going into the food stamp program, the food banks, the welfare programs that we think of as characterizing that 60s American.
Because this is something we can fix in can-do kind of moonshot style.
Right.
Like there shouldn't be hungry people in the middle of these prosperous cities, just, you know, a few blocks from financial centers. Like we can fix this.
That's right. And Johnson signed in, Johnson signed the Food Stamp Act in 1964, which was sort of part of his overall sort of war on poverty that included Medicaid and Head Start and mm-hmm. Job Corps. You know, it was just like you say, like this, we're the best and the brightest, and there's nothing that we can't solve with another layer of administration and a promise that we're going to combat inequality. So food stamps came back in the 60s. There were two kinds, right? There's orange food stamps, which are food stamps that were for stuff that you wanted, and blue food stamps, which were stamps for stuff that was good for you. And if you bought enough orange ones, you got all these blue ones, and that was how you were, that's how food was subsidized.
What is an example of a bonus food in this scenario? Is it junk food?
Salt cod. No, you're not. Junk food isn't supposed to be on the list. The thing about milk and cheese and butter is that they are they're stuff that is presumed to be a staple. I mean, it's stuff that we think of everyone.
Every kitchen's got to have it.
And yet it's a, you know, it's an industry, it's a marketplace. And if the price of butter starts to swing too widely, it creates a state of perceived food emergency. Now, you can always cook with vegetable oil.
Margarine.
You don't need milk.
You got parquet.
But especially then, the idea that a child needed 3 glasses of milk a day in order to be healthy. I mean, there was some mythology built into the importance of cheese and milk.
And I assume a lot of that mythology just starts out in as an industry marketing push, right? Like,
well, but we had such a
science tells you your bones need calcium.
Yeah,
I guess
that's right.
So even if Wisconsin is not trying to fool you into buying filling your kids with milk, you're going to sense that it's wholesome.
A much less sophisticated food science world where we couldn't interpret all the vitamins and minerals that were in food. We were just kind of looking at them and going, well, let's see, if you give this kid milk, he gets nice and fat and healthy. And if you don't give him milk,
there were a lot of wrong guesses. Yeah. I mean, all the discourage fat, but fill kids with sugar stuff that we had for about 20 years kind of backfired.
Yeah. That wasn't so good.
It turns out in hindsight.
In the early 70s, as part of the global inflation, the gas crisis, the economic topsy-turvy of the early 70s, there was an incredible spike in the price of milk.
Oh.
Milk went up 30% in the course of just a number of weeks.
It's like the gas thing, but the cars are all lining up at the at the A&P. Like a gallon of milk is what?
Yeah. Yeah. No, we don't have our milk. It was a super.
What were the causes? Do you know?
Well, it was the like the causes of all these kind of price fluctuations. There was, you know, the price of gas made it more difficult to deliver foods and so the price of milk went up, and the government, in trying to respond to consumer panic, the government intervened and put price controls on how much you could charge for milk and dairy, which affected farmers and their willingness to produce milk, because now they were all crying poverty.
It's cutting into their profits.
Yeah, and claiming that it wasn't profitable to produce milk. And so during the 70s, during the Carter administration, the government stepped into the gap and said, well, we need to put price controls on milk, but we're also going to give you subsidies in the form of buying surplus milk and butter at this price floor, right? We're going to set a minimum price for your product.
So you guarantee a sale of everything because Uncle Sam wants your milk.
At which point the price guarantee for that milk stuff, the milk products, was high enough that it incentivized dairy farmers to increase production. That increase in production did not increase prices, because the government was buying the surplus and keeping a price control on what consumers paid. And dairy farmers increased production dramatically. Government.
Sure, it just increased the size of the market.
Because it's just like, hey, man, you know, we're getting guaranteed income from this.
I don't have to worry about selling all this.
Yeah. And so the government got into the business of buying cheese, buying dairy product. And cheese and butter were ways that you could take milk, process it, and make it somewhat shelf-stable, storable, right? You couldn't just keep 30 million gallons of milk.
Where does the government put all this stuff?
Well, they were buying so much cheese, and so much cheese was being produced, that they had to build warehouses.
Just for their new...
Giant refrigerated warehouses stacked to the ceiling with pallets of 5-pound blocks of processed cheese. And the processing, you know, was another factor that made the cheese shelf stable. Mm-hmm. The addition of emulsifiers and other kind of orange food colorings and things that would keep the cheese that would allow you to stack it in pallets. But in a very short amount of time, you know, the government had always maintained a certain kind of cheese stockpile.
You never know.
But by 1980, we had 500 million pounds of cheese.
Do you think this is the reason for the fondue fad? Some deep state attempt to get us to eat?
The fondue fad was a little earlier, right? And that was the first.
Yeah, late 70s. That right? That's Carter era.
I always thought it was a 60s thing. Yeah, I thought fondue was a 60s thing. Mm. Maybe your parents got into it in the 70s.
If they had just brought back fondue, maybe.
Well, what they did, I mean, kind of like the Nutria attempts to control Nutria by making it a menu item in southern kitchens, that didn't really work. There was no shortage of use for processed American cheese. It was just that this cheese was not making it to consumers. It was sitting in warehouses because
there was too much of it, right?
Yeah, like, and the threat of releasing it to the public would depress cheese prices even further. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, talk about an inefficient system. The government,
you're working both ends,
right? And taxpayers were paying to buy this cheese in order to have us save money on cheese at the supermarket. Eventually, you're going to pay for the cheese one way or another.
I feel like you got to pick a side. If you want to prop up the industry, prop up the industry, but you can't, like, you know, you can't do both.
Well, in 1981, Ronald Reagan comes into office, and he campaigned on the sort of you know, the original old school Republican talking points of we need to streamline government. We need
smaller, less efficient government.
Yeah.
What do you talk about? The cheese?
Smaller, more efficient government.
Sorry, what did I say? Less efficient?
Yeah.
I guess that's probably what it turned into.
It is what it turned into. But, you know, Reagan got elected in the hangover of the Johnson and Carter welfare state years. And he made a big appeal to the American middle, saying we're spending too much money and there are a bunch of freeloaders and everybody out there is getting all this free welfare and we're going to cut out the waste.
He used surprisingly not coded references to who would be getting this thing. Welfare moms. Mm-hmm. And I believe there's tape of him saying, like, does he say big black bucks at one point?
Yeah, big black
bucks. He says, you know,
referring to men.
Yes. From when he was governor of California onward, there's plenty of tape of him just making not very coded racial appeals to the dangers of building up a welfare state.
And he was not aware of the cheese surplus.
He was not. He didn't have code status?
No, nobody walked into his office and whispered in his ear, like, we've got 500 million extra pounds.
As soon as you're president, they show you the alien autopsy tape and they show you the cheese warehouse.
The cheese problem was something that people in the FDA and people in the Carter administration were aware of, so much so that at one point, one of the administrators of the program said that probably the best thing we could do with this 500 million pounds of cheese is dump it in the ocean because it's all starting to get moldy, and it ends up costing more to refrigerate it and store it.
Wow.
than the cheese is worth.
Yeah, energy is expensive.
So Reagan gets elected, and he immediately starts slashing the welfare state. This is during the ketchup is a vegetable years of the Reagan administration, and there's a lot of pushback and a lot of criticism of his administration, and part of it starts to incorporate this narrative that we have all this cheese stored in American warehouses while meanwhile people are going hungry. Mm-hmm. How can you countenance this, you who promises us greater efficiency? And so Reagan, in the stroke of a pen, forms the Temporary Emergency Food Assistance Program, TFAP.
You're faster than me.
And in 1981, starts a program where he says, we're going to give away this cheese. We've got too much cheese. We've got poor people in America. And
healthful cheese coming their
way. Here comes some healthy cheese. And all the states have to do is ask for it. And we will deliver it unto them.
The cheese doors will be open, and here it comes.
Like some cheese, you will receive 3 million pounds
so
of cheese,
much cheese
tomorrow.
It's like when you were on a Nickelodeon show in the 80s and you said cheese, and they dumped a bunch of processed cheese on you.
And it really is what happened to the United States.
Did every state sign up?
Eventually, a lot of states. I'm not sure if every state signed up for it. California was the first. And received, you know, 30 million pounds of cheese like in a wave. And then other states realized, like, oh, we got to get in on this cheese thing. And so cheese became, and in particular, this kind of 5-pound block of unsliced processed cheese food became.
How big is that? 5 pounds.
5-pound block of cheese. It's like what you would think of as a. I mean, it's bigger than a brick.
It's like a cinder block, right?
It's smaller than a cinder block, bigger than a brick. Okay. So it's bigger than a gold ingot.
It's smaller than a bread box.
You could put it in a bread box.
But you wouldn't want to. It's not refrigerated.
Right. It's smaller than a loaf of bread.
Okay.
This cheese food became a way that everybody.
A way or a way?
Oh, no. Where's the bell? God, I got to get that bell out of the box. Just every once in a while, you deserve one.
Where'd the
one.
Bell even go?
I don't know.
Did your daughter steal your bell?
She did. Every once in a while, you deserve a ding, and that was one. It was a moment in time where the farmers continued to receive their subsidy to produce, but Reagan, as part of his program of greater efficiency started to try to reduce those price supports, which was
that's to their credit, because that's kind of his voters, you know. Right. Like, he's not just sticking it to the inner cities. Yeah, he's actually in a principled way saying some of these agricultural things are out of
he was playing against type, but he was doing that as a kind of, I mean, in the meantime, he was also completely gutting the welfare state.
Sure.
And so, a little tip of the hat, he also like reduced farm subsidies.
Little lipstick on the pig.
But processed cheese and American cheese and what became known as government cheese was a thing that if you had food stamps, if you went to the food bank, you could get this 5-pound block of cheese and it wouldn't count against you, right? Like your food stamp money, you didn't have to use it to buy the cheese.
You could just get unlimited cheese in addition to your food stamps.
Maybe not unlimited. You couldn't go in and get a 500 boxes of cheese, but every...
If you wanted to make like a snow fort out of
it. Every month or every week, whenever you went to get your food, a 5-pound block of cheese was included with your regular box.
I wonder if you had to ask or if it just showed up.
I think you could say like, no cheese for me, thanks.
But if your family is skating by in Reagan's increasingly threadbare world, then, you know, any calories right. You just want for your kids, right?
And it's and this is part of why it became a source of mockery, is that this was contemporaneous with the new era of food snobs that prior either didn't exist or only lived in Paris and New York. Mm-hmm. People who were prepared to spend exorbitant amounts of money on, you know, tiny things that were, you know,
The mid-20th century is funny because when you think about what fancy restaurants had, it was, you know, they would have like three things.
Pork chops.
They'd have a steak or, yeah, exactly.
In France, it
chicken
was like
cordon bleu.
Pork chop with butter on it.
Right. It wasn't like today where, you know, there's a, this will have an avocado blackberry reduction right. Spooned over the, you know.
I mean, that
complexity came later.
That was, that existed at some point, but it was not a middle class. Middle sure. class did not have have access to fancy food.
I don't think it was the aesthetic of even higher end America.
No, it didn't exist, right? I mean, what if you were a rich person in America in the 60s and 70s, what you did was you had steak for dinner 5 nights a week. You
finally.
Didn't, you know, you didn't have anything that was especially sophisticated. You just had more. And in the 80s, you started to have a yuppie culture that was looking for fancy things.
Sushi. And
That was, you know, it coincided with the rise of this sort of mass-produced, processed, orange food-colored, and very pungent block of cheese provided by the government.
Was this, because that's humiliating anyway.
Really?
Was the spoilage an issue? Like, would you sometimes get not good cheese, or was it just that all the cheese was not good cheese?
I mean, I think if they pulled a block of 5-pound cheese out of a warehouse and it was green, I don't know what they did with it, whether they hucked it in a bin or whether they just scraped the green off. But that's the thing about cheese. It can go...
Yeah.
South, and it's still cheese. It gets more cheese.
Cut the moldy part off.
But government cheese became a what was it? It was a line in the sand, a demarcator. If you were above government cheese or below it, and you
might not even know about it if you're on the higher end, right? Like,
well, you heard about it because it was a stand-in insult,
yeah.
Right? It was just right. Like, how's your government cheese? It became one of those ways that America decided it was going to...
Living in America at the time, did you know which of your friends had government cheese houses?
Yeah, you did. You understood, I think, who received assistance, mm-hmm. who was on assistance, I guess, is what we said. It became a point of pride or reverse snobbery. I mean, you hear government cheese referred to in rap lyrics a lot.
Sure.
You hear it. You hear people talk about it with a kind of nostalgia about their
80s upbringing.
Yeah, their rough upbringing. Yeah. By the early 90s, we had drawn down our surplus of cheese.
Yeah, it worked.
Such that there was no longer this 5-pound block of cheese waiting for everybody.
We can put munitions back in those warehouses.
That's right. Well, no, it was just that
Kwanzaa huts full of
poor people now got truffles and and caviar in their boxes.
That's what I hear.
Everyone.
That's what I hear from Sarah Palin.
I dated a girl in the early 90s who was on food stamps, and I ate meals that she created out of her government assistance. And it was all, I mean, she made wonderful, nutritious meals from it, but she was on food stamps and also was a hippie. So she went to the food bank and picked only the things that looked, you know, that looked like she could make a hippie meal out of it. We never had government cheese.
She turned down the cheese.
Yeah, she did.
At the cashier, they're like trying to push it on her.
But the term government cheese sort of disappeared, I think, from the lexicon after the 90s, at least as a signifier of class and status. When I used the term a couple of times this week with people a little younger than me, they had never really. I think they'd heard it in rap lyrics, but Chris Rock
routines or something.
There wasn't like that firsthand knowledge of.
It didn't take them back.
Well, it didn't take them back. And also, you know, the guilty pleasure that we felt about government cheese, which was it melts better. The nachos are better.
I was just thinking a lot of this food snobbery is absolutely cultural relativism. Like as a kid, I remember wanting my mom to buy me the bologna with the flecks of pickle and pimento in it. And of course that's gross food,
yeah.
But as a kid, you would have to be told, hey, that's not cool to like that.
Yeah.
Like my eyes would light up at that kind of a stuff.
For me, when I started to feel obligated by my hippie girlfriends to not make grilled cheese with Kraft slices, I like mourned that even melting, good old-fashioned, salty, orange American cheese that sets us apart from our French and English neighbors.
To this day, when my daughter orders a grilled cheese, she will expect cheddar. And if it's American cheese, she will turn up her little nose.
Really?
And I don't think it's anything we taught her, but I think we raised her in a world where there was cheddar in the fridge because that's what upwardly mobile people have.
Well, she may see, the world may change again.
Okay.
Because in the last couple of years, one of the byproducts of the Trump administration's trade war with China and other global economies has been that the government has had to step in and start subsidizing, putting both price controls and subsidies in effect where...
We used to export dairy, and now those markets are shrinking.
Yeah, and the government has started buying cheese again, and
reopen the Quonset huts.
As of just now, there's a $1.5 billion surplus of cheese building up in our American refrigerated warehouse network, and there's some suggestion that maybe. Well, I mean, definitely we dump it in the ocean or it starts being free again.
If you're in the future and our civilization ended at some point where we had a cheese surplus, you will know immediately where that place is. Just follow your nose.
So future Indiana Joneses will be rolling in through caves just looking for that giant tower of cheese.
And that concludes Government Cheese. Entry 541.1S1718, certificate number 24553, in the omnibus. Now, Futurelings, another thing we had a surplus of in our time was bad tweets and posts, and as a result, you could always find the omnibus's digital footprint at Omnibus Project on all of our generation's worst social media outlets. You could follow me at Twitter as @KenJennings. You could see John's delightful pictures of neighborhood signage and graffiti and other urban wreckage on Instagram as @JohnRoderick. So enroll in the Futurelings on Facebook if you want to discuss raccoons or manhole covers or whatever they're talking about now. I feel like some people try to enroll and are mystified why they get turned down. We only turn you down if you don't check the box that says, I will abide by the rules of this fan page or something. So make sure you do that.
Right. Oh, yeah. You have to answer some questions.
Questions three. And it doesn't matter what you say.
I mean, it matters. I read them.
I read them too, but if somebody put anything, I will accept them.
If in answer to the question, what kind of futureling are you, they say anything, you'll accept that?
I will.
Okay, actually. All right.
The only problem is if some people do not answer the, do you agree to the group rules?
Oh.
And then, you know.
Right, we can't have a bunch of libertarians in there who don't agree with the rules.
I make my own rules.
Listen, we're a socialist economy at the futurelings.
Here's what Ayn Rand would say about your dopey questions.
You know what, man? Ayn Rand does not speak for all libertarians.
So if you have tried to join the Facebook group and it was unsuccessful, don't get your feelings hurt. Just make sure you check the box that says, I agree to the group rules. It's not that hard.
You know what? I'd just like to make a more sweeping and general statement. Don't get your feelings hurt.
At all, ever.
Try not to.
What's the upside of it?
Right? I mean, yeah, like I understand it happens sometimes occasionally, but don't like go looking for it.
Definitely don't tell John about it on social media. That's not what he wants.
No. Write to Ken about it at theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
I will be warm and woke and sensitive to all your concerns. If you want to send us government cheese hates regular cheese. Actually, don't send us government cheese.
No, you can send your grandmother's government cheese recipes.
Exactly. We want all your...
But Ken already has them all.
We want your box of 3x5 cards with different Cool Whip-based cuisine.
My copy of Joy of Cooking already has all that stuff, all those magazine articles tucked in the pages.
Please send us pictures of hams with pineapple rings and cherries on them. That's what I want. And cloves stuck in them at intervals. Send those to Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744. Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Many of you have chosen to support the Omnibus Project materially to make sure these entries continue. This is our 200th entry, John. Are you aware?
Really?
It is.
Episode 200.
Episode 200. Entry 200. And it feels like we've done so many of these, but we are not even a fraction of the world's knowledge is contained in this time capsule yet.
That's right. So much more work to do.
There is a lot more work to do. And we appreciate those of you who have donated materially, fiscally, to make this possible. If you would like to continue the ongoing security of the Omnibus for another 200 shows or beyond, you can do that by contributing, by becoming a patron at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Your financial generosity is what keeps the show going.
Well, futurelings, I assume that you are all a form of self-aware green bean casserole. picturing you.
Do they think with the French fried onions?
They do.
Is that the brain of the pulsing mass?
They're all just sitting in a convection oven somewhere, listening to this program and wondering about a time before the Great Thanksgiving. From our vantage point in your distant past, distant past, we've basically grown up in the interregnum between the two great eras of free cheese. But we have no idea how long this civilization will survive. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, especially if that catastrophe is that we all drown in a cheese wave.
Boy.
But if the worst comes soon,
the cheese wave, I'll tell you that.
I know, right? If the worst comes soon,
that would not be Gouda.
If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.